Janjana Shalakaya Chakshur Militam Jaina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manopistam Stapitam Jaina Kutale Svayam Rupa Padamayam Tathati Shapatantikam Tandeham Shri Gura Shri Jatapatakam Shri Guru Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Swahana Bhagavatam Vitam Stam Sadhimam Sadvetam Sadhutam Prajana Setam Krishna Chaitam Nadevam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Swahana Lavita Sri Vishakam Vitam Stam Hey Krishna Karuna Sindhau Dina Banto Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kam Shana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vansha Gopatadrupyascha Kripa Sindhu Yeva Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasa Adi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama Thank you very much for coming and taking part this evening. As mentioned, today is the 67th anniversary of the founding of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And I've been asked to speak about that. And I don't know about you, but a lot of people are wary of institutions, and especially spiritual institutions. I think I'm one of them. Having been a member for 65 years, it hasn't worn off. I'm still wary of spiritual institutions, maybe more wary than when I joined. Institutions have they can be scary, yeah? Organized and hierarchies and rules and all of those things. And yet, Srila Prabhupada founded one. And how are we to look at that? On the one side, spiritual institutions or any spiritual any kind of institution carries with it certain dangers. They can be oppressive. They can be, they can be instruments of persecution. They can just be oppressively dead. They can be all sorts of things that we'd rather not be. Coercive. And on the other side, they get things done. They give us, they fulfill needs that we have. Prabhupada called it the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And he, when he outlined its aims, one of the aims was to bring people closer to one another and closer to the prime entity, Krishna. To bring people closer to one another and closer to Krishna, the center of all existence.
We need a society. Man is a...
I guess you'd say now people is a social animal. We need society. We don't function very well in isolation. When they want to punish people, they put them in isolation so that they can go pretty crazy. We want association. And that association is, in fact, crucial for the development of spiritual consciousness or for spiritual advancement, because it's by association of spiritually advanced people that we get spiritual inspiration and spiritual knowledge and understanding, and that our lives change and move in a spiritual direction. According to the company that we keep, we'll develop in a certain way. If we associate with thieves, we'll start to pick pockets or rob banks. If we associate with scholars, we'll start to write papers and speculate about different interesting topics. If we associate with drunkards, we'll probably wind up drinking, according to our company. So for spiritual progress, it's important to have the company of spiritual people. And that involves doing something, pulling people together in a kind of systematic way. There must be leaders automatically. Get a group of monkeys together, one of them is going to wind up being a leader. Put 10 people in a room. 9 people are going to be followers, or 8 will be followers, and 1 or 2 will be leaders. Not everyone wants to lead. And some people have to lead. Others, but we need to be together with like-minded people. And especially for spiritual progress. So my thought, maybe even conviction, is that what makes a spiritual organization valuable is ultimately the saintly people within that institution. The institution may have, you can look at it in terms of its the number of centers or churches or temples or mosques it has. You can look at its bank balance, you can look at its so many things, the size of its membership rolls. But finally, what makes it valuable is the company of saintly people. If there's one saintly person, then that changes everything. If we can get even one moment's association with a genuinely saintly person, just that one moment can open the door to spiritual perfection. Sarva-siddhi means all perfection. Just by a moment's company with a person who's genuinely advanced in Krishna consciousness, God consciousness.
There's a relevant text in Srimad Bhagavatam. Is everyone familiar with Srimad Bhagavatam? Who's not familiar? Who is? Just about everybody. With one or two hands not up. Srimad Bhagavatam is like the postgraduate course. Bhagavad Gita is probably well known to everyone. The quintessential book of spiritual wisdom coming in the Vedic tradition. And Srimad Bhagavatam is like the graduate study from Bhagavad Gita. After we finish Bhagavad Gita, where the Bhagavad Gita leaves off, Srimad Bhagavatam begins. The Bhagavad Gita is relatively short, 700 verses. The Bhagavatam is about 18,000 verses. So it's a very detailed study of the science of God, and very relishable. It's compared to the Vedic literature is compared to a tree that can give us whatever we desire. Whatever we might desire, we can find in the Vedic literature. And the Srimad Bhagavatam is compared to the ripe fruit of that tree. The ripe fruit of the tree. And that fruit is described as being so ripe that it's almost like juice. You know, when a fruit is super ripe, it's almost all juice. It's just held together a little bit by the skin. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is described as being like that, as being so soft that you can practically drink the fruit. Well, it's the ripe fruit of all Vedic knowledge, Srimad Bhagavatam. It's complete in 12 cantos, and this is a text from the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhavadvita Bhagavatas Tirtha Bhuta Svayam Vibho Tirti Kurvanti Tirtani Svantakstena Gadabhata. This is a verse spoken to the great saintly devotee Vidura. Vidura is well known in the epic Mahabharata. He was the half-brother of Dhritarashtra, the evil-minded king. And he, out of duty, served at the court for many years. But due to the nastiness of the politics in the palace, one day he just left and went traveling to different holy places for spiritual enlightenment. He was essentially the prime minister, and he just left for the life of a sage. And he returned only many years later in order to enlighten his brother, Dhritarashtra, which he successfully did.
But now, before we come to that, this verse is spoken to him.
What chapter and verse?
Well, it's chapter 13, text 10, for those who have little gizmos that allow you to follow along. He returned to the palace after many, many years, and the palace residents expressed their great pleasure in seeing him. And if I'm not wrong, I think I'm not wrong, because I haven't exactly.
Yes. Yes. Now he's being received at the palace, and this verse is addressed to him, perhaps by Yudhisthira Maharaj. This is the disadvantage of these machines, is you only get one page at a time. You can't flip around. But I believe that's the context. And the translation says, my Lord, speaking to him, Vidura, devotees like your good self are verily holy places personified. Because you carry the personality of Godhead within your heart,
you turn all places into places of pilgrimage. Purport. The personality of Godhead is omnipresent by his diverse potencies everywhere. Just as the power of electricity is distributed everywhere within space. Similarly, the Lord's omnipresence is perceived and manifested by his unalloyed devotees like Vidura, just as electricity is manifested in an electric bulb. It's sort of axiomatic. God is everywhere. You commonly hear this, that God is omnipresent. God is everywhere. Spiritual energy is everywhere. But we don't perceive that. We don't walk around seeing God everywhere. We see all these New Yorkers and traffic lights and traffic and buildings and whatever else is out there. Or we go out to the countryside, we see trees, we see flowers. And yet, we're told that God is everywhere. And it's confirmed in the Vedic literature. Prasya Shaktir Vividaiva Shrimite. God is present everywhere by his diverse energies. As the sun is everywhere by its heat and light, so Krishna is present everywhere by his energies. And everything ultimately is God's energy. And yet we don't see that way. But here's the opportunity. When there's a saintly person like Vidura, then God's presence becomes palpable, it becomes manifest, it becomes capable of being experienced. Just as in this room there's electricity everywhere, there's wires in the walls and electric current, but it's manifest through these lights. When the lights turned on, then you see the electricity in tangible form. Otherwise it's sort of an abstract reality, you know it's there. There's one of those sockets and we sort of know that there's electricity behind it. But when there's a light, then we see, yes, here's what electricity can do. But when there's a saintly person like Vidura, then his very presence is enlightening. And Srila Prabhupada further explains, a pure devotee like Vidura always feels the presence of the Lord everywhere. He sees everything in the potency of the Lord and the Lord in everything. Well, that's his consciousness. Yomam pashyati sarvatra sarvam cha mayi pashyati tasyaham na pranashyami sachame na pranashyati. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, for one who sees me everywhere and sees everything within me, I'm never lost. And he's never lost to me. So a person like Vidura experiences that. He sees that. He's on that level of consciousness. And when we come in touch with him, then we're coming in touch with that level of consciousness. The holy places all over the earth are meant for purifying the polluted consciousness of the human being by an atmosphere surcharged with the presence of the Lord's unalloyed devotees. If anyone visits a holy place, he must search out the pure devotees residing in such holy places, take lessons from them, try to apply such instructions in practical life, and thus gradually prepare oneself for the ultimate salvation, going back to Godhead. There are, in India especially, holy places like Haridwar and Rishikesh and Varanasi, Vrindavan, Mayapur, Kurukshetra, Puri, Tirupati. Literally thousands of such places. There are sacred rivers like the Ganges. Or in other traditions, there are holy cities like Jerusalem or Mecca, which are revered as holy places. And here, we're told what makes them actually a holy place. And that's the presence of a holy person, of a spiritually enlightened person. Because when we go to such a place, such persons like to be in a spiritual place, a spiritual holy place. And when we go there, we can take the opportunity to find such a person and inquire from him about the meaning of life, about how to live in spiritual life, how to apply that understanding in our practical activities. All of these things are possible, so that one can achieve the perfection of life, ultimately to at the time of death, which comes for everyone, to go back to Godhead, back to the spiritual world, back to Krishna. To go to some holy place of pilgrimage does not mean only to take a bath in the Ganges or Jamuna, or to visit the temples situated in those places. One should also find representatives of Vidura who have no desire in life save and except to serve the personality of Godhead. People go to a holy place just to go. They have some idea that the place is holy and I should visit this place at least once in my life, or as often as I can. But when they go there, they don't exactly know how to take the full advantage. They go and they have their picture taken, standing in front of some ancient landmark. Or they go and there's a river there like the Jordan or the Ganga or the Jamuna, and they take a holy dip in the sacred river, and they feel that, yes, now I've come to this holy place and I've bathed in this sacred river. Or they perform some religious rituals in the holy place. They circumambulate something a few times. Maybe they chant some mantras, or they so many things that people do in these holy places. And that's all right, but that's not how one gets the ultimate benefit. One gets the ultimate benefit by that association with saintly person. And Prabhupada said, the personality of Godhead is always with such pure devotees because of their unalloyed service, which is without any tinge of fruitive action or utopian speculation. The pure devotees are not acting to enjoy something in this world, to get some money, to get some followers, to get some beautiful women surrounding them, attentive to their desires. And they're not simply interested in speculating about different theories and sort of beating the next philosopher. Yes, that's a very good thesis, so it's quite interesting, but it seems to me that a better approach would be, and and I think you've got it mostly right, but at this point, I have to say, and one wants to, every philosopher wants to have a different idea from the other philosophers and make his mark and argue. But the pure devotee has no such purpose. His only purpose, his only motive, is to serve the personality of God. That's his only goal, his only purpose. Such devotees are in the actual service of the Lord, specifically by the process of hearing and chanting. These are the most important methods of spiritual culture. So the pure devotees hear from the authorities and chant and sing and write of the glories of the Lord. Mahamuni Vyasadeva, the author of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, heard from Narada, the great sage, and then he chanted in writing. Sukadeva Goswami studied from his father and he described it to Parikshit. That's the way of Srimad Bhagavatam, that's the subject matter of the Bhagavatam. So they were hearing and then they were describing or speaking or writing. So by their actions, the pure devotees of the Lord can render any place into a place of pilgrimage. And the holy places are worth the name only on their account. Such pure devotees are able to rectify the polluted atmosphere of any place. And what to speak of a holy place rendered unholy by the questionable actions of interested persons who try to adopt a professional life at the cost of the reputation of a holy place. And we see that we go to a holy place and there are sort of professional priests there or professional Brahmins or Pujaris or some sort of people whose job is to make a living there. Sometimes just by such things as selling souvenirs, or by a sort of pay-as-you-go ritual performance. They're eager to, when they see a new pilgrim, they get all excited, and maybe even chase him down. They've got dollar signs or rupee signs or shekel signs or some sort of money signs glittering in their eyes. And they themselves are not very advanced. They're maybe doing all sorts of very materialistic things. But they're sort of cashing in on the reputation of the holy place at the expense of the pilgrims. And so it's sort of a combination of cheaters and cheated. The people come there not really with the clear understanding of getting any spiritual benefit, but just sort of to add it to their bintu map. And then there are people waiting to sell them a postcard. You've been here. And that doesn't really help anyone. So, on the other hand, those who are actually advanced in spiritual understanding purify those places, even if all sorts of other things are going on there. If there's one pure devotee, His presence sanctifies the whole place. So these holy places can be thought of as institutions. Sometimes they're described as it's like an institution. Jerusalem or Vrindavan or Mecca is like a, you could say, like an institution. And to go there is established as an institutional function. But what purifies those institutions, those places, is the presence of even one pure devotee. And so, coming to my point, this International Society for Krishna Consciousness is purified, or it enables us to experience the presence of Krishna by the presence of pure devotees. It was founded here in the Lower East Side by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, from whom we're hearing in these books, and who brought about a wave of Krishna consciousness, manifest in a change in people's lives, manifest in a profusion of spiritual literature, manifest in the spreading of this Mahamantra, Hare Krishna Mantra, manifest in so many different ways. And it happened because of his exalted level of spiritual consciousness, because he had no interest in enjoying something for himself. He had no interest in just speculating and philosophizing. His only interest was to serve Krishna. So it was by his presence that really the whole society was started. It was by his presence that it grew. And it's still his presence that inspires us in Krishna consciousness and makes the society, or invigorates the society, infuses it with Krishna consciousness. On the other hand, he didn't have in mind that he would be the last of the pure devotees. You know, we'll write a book, The Last of the Pure Devotees. That wasn't his idea at all, and he would be very unhappy, in fact, if that were to be where things wound up. Rather, he desired that others, that we should all become pure devotees. In another book, Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's a description of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his chanting party. He used to go around the town, around the city, chanting this Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama. He used to go chanting with his companions. And it's described there that they would have a dancer who was sort of the lead dancer up front, and they would have so many people playing hand cymbals, maybe 8 people playing hand cymbals, and 2 or 4 people playing drums. They would have all of these, you know, the ensemble was like that. So Srila Prabhupada was writing to someone, I think maybe to someone here in New York, perhaps elsewhere, to one of the leaders, and saying that you should also organize your chanting party like that, with someone in front dancing, and this many people playing cymbals, this many people playing drums. And the most important thing, he said, was that every member of the kirtan party, every member of the chanting party, should be a pure devotee. That's the crucial thing. Not to be a great musician, not to be anything else. but to be a pure devotee of Krishna. That was his instruction. That, because that's the goal, that's the natural healthy position of the soul, to be a pure devotee of Krishna. And to be in that healthy condition is what enables one to bring others to spiritual health also. So Srila Prabhupada gave this method for practically achieving that platform. It's not just sentimental, something nice and fuzzy. But it was a practical process by which our consciousness becomes purified. And our purified consciousness becomes manifest by actual service to Krishna. Service by hearing, service by chanting or writing, service by remembering Krishna, service by using our senses in the service of Krishna. That was his teaching. And it's by that spirit of service that our heart becomes purified and the institution becomes a vehicle for spreading spiritual purity. So, another time, Srila Prabhupada was talking about Mahajans. Mahajan means a great person, a great source. And there's a list of 12, sort of a canonical list, or a list of 12 recognized persons who are known as Mahajans. And Srila Prabhupada was talking to his secretary, and he was describing that list. Swayambhu, Lord Brahma, Narad Muni, who we heard about in the text here, Shambhu, Lord Shiva, Kumaras, Kapila. In this way, there are 12 great authorities, Mahajans, like all exalted devotees of Krishna. So then Srila Prabhupada's secretary was quite clever and quick. He said, "And you're the 13th, Srila Prabhupada." And Srila Prabhupada said, "And you're the 14th. And that was his goal. Not that he should be the last of the pure devotees, but that every one of us should have this opportunity to take up pure devotional service and should actually take it and make our lives successful and distribute it to others. And that's the purpose of this International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And I think we'll stop here and see what kind of questions you might have. What sort of questions might be bubbling up?
Reaction to bring everything back to Prabhupada, and it's all, you know, it's all the glory goes to Prabhupada, and so on and so on. And then, sort of on the other side of the spectrum, there are individual devotees, and it's going, I'm not placing any judgment, just observing who have sort of a notoriety and influence in society at large. Almost kind of like on their own term, in a way. And so I was wondering if, I don't know, if you could comment on that sort of dialectic that seems to exist in this time today.
Yeah. Society means diversity. Whenever you have a society, if it's a genuine society, you'll have diversity. You won't have, back in the days when ISKCON was thought of, when I was like 22 and ISKCON was a youth call. There was a group of people who put forward the idea that the devotees were all brainwashed. And when you chanted Hare Krishna, they took away your ability to think. And so everybody, just does the same thing because they can't think anymore. They chant that mantra so much, they can't think for themselves. And that's been, over the years, thoroughly disproven by the remarkable variety of opinions held within the society, by the remarkable diversity of points of view. So that somebody looks at things this way, and somebody looks at things that way, and somebody feels strongly that it should be like this, and someone else strongly feels it should be like that. Well, that's actually a sign of health. It's okay that we have shaved heads, but if we were all like shaved-headed robots, up and down, all doing the same thing in the same way, we'd be pretty sick people. So there's this remarkable diversity, which is reflects the nature of the soul. There are philosophies that say everything is one, and we're all one, and one, 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 one. I one time attended a little meeting of enthusiasts for a guru who was popular back in the early 70s, and they had this one fellow who was playing a guitar, and he had this little sort of anthem that he was singing. We're one spirit, we're one in the Lord, and we know that our unity will one day be restored. Everything's one. And then we come to ISKCON, and there's all sorts of disunity. There's all this diversity of opinion. And in fact, one of my fellow students once wrote to Srila Prabhupada and sort of complained that there's all this lack of unity. And he said, I think this is a sign of impersonalism. And Prabhupada wrote back and said, no, it's a sign of personalism. Everyone is an individual person. And therefore, everyone has an individual way of looking at things. Everyone has his own point of view. And to think that everybody is going to be, that there'll be absolute oneness and everyone will see everything the same way, is utopian. That's not how it works, even on the spiritual platform. So there's this, these features. And in one sense, they're good. That there may be a tendency for me to think that now I'm the leader here, and I'm the one who really knows, and everyone should really see it my way and follow me and look up to me, and me, me, me. And then there's, on the other side, there'll be those who'll say, it's not all about you, it's not all about anyone, it's all about Krishna, and we don't want leaders of any sort, especially puffed up, egocentric. That's healthy. That's good. When you have balloons, it's nice to have pins handy. let some of the air out and bring us back down to earth. But as Prabhupada says, things, Krishna consciousness is not sentimental. Either one way, oh, you're so wonderful, or the other way, get out of here, I hate your guts. We don't want leaders around here.
We just want you to be our leader.
It's practical. We try to understand the science of Krishna. We try to appreciate the presence of Krishna in all of his devotees. And we try to recognize when a devotee is advanced. He may not be the chairman of the board. He may not be the pastor or the swami or the imam. He may be someone else. He may be the person who's cleaning the floor of the temple. And our job is to recognize Krishna's presence there, to appreciate those pure devotees, and to seek out their association and try to become pure ourselves. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm. To kind of continue what you were saying, every level of initiation, everybody takes on a name that is like Srila Prabhupada, his birth name is Abhichoyabha or something.
Mm-hmm.
And every level of initiation, you take on a name that helps deflate the ego. Usually, like Srila Prabhupada is the teacher of teachers.
Mm-hmm.
But to exalt any living sannyasi or Brahmin, there's the fear of pride, then undermining their own advancement. Having already disappeared this earth, to exalt Srila Prabhupada for everything he did, there's no fear that his ego is going to inflate and allow him to lose his vision of where he was, where we there are, in my opinion, every devotee is advanced and great just for having taken on the path, having kind of grasped and seen what the point is and having began on that journey at whatever level they're at in the journey, just having taken the journey or advancing on it shows enlightenment and greatness. But the fear, with pride being the seed of all the seven deadly sins, that to exalt anyone, I mean, you've been around long enough to remember Bhaktivinoda.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody gets too much power. Power is the great corruptor.
Yeah.
It allows people to then think that they are the deified ruler.
Ye bhaje she bhava. You're quite right. Kaviraj Goswami says, one who's engaged in the service of Krishna, he's great. Doesn't matter. Prabhupada said, big or small. There's no big devotee or small devotee. Everyone's a devotee. Not that we miscategorize like that. No, he's big, he's small. Or especially, I'm big, that they're small. And Lord Chaitanya taught that amani na manade. One should think oneself less significant than the grass. How important is the grass? A blade of grass. Everybody walks on it. And still the grass doesn't protest. The grass doesn't say, hey, I'm calling my attorney. Who do you think you are? Grass is all right. I'm the grass. It's fine. So Lord Chaitanya said, this is the person who can chant Hare Krishna all the time. Person who's humble, like the grass, who's more tolerant than a tree. People sit on the tree, they strip its bark, they carve hearts and initials into it, they take its fruit, they take its branches. And the tree never protests. So Lord Chaitanya said that we should be like that. Actually, at the time of initiation, the name one gets
is Das, or Dasi. Das is masculine, Dasi is feminine. And what does it mean? It means servant. Not master of the universe, but servant of the master of the universe. And better than servant of the master of the universe is servant of the servant. Servant of the servant. And better than servant of the servant is servant of the servant of the servant. Prabhupada said the more time you add servant, the higher your position. More time we add servant. So this is Lord Chaitanya's teaching. Now, for the benefit of the student, a function is to offer respect to the teacher. That's necessary for the student's benefit. But the teacher shouldn't think, I deserve all the apples because I'm great. You should think that I'm doing Krishna's work and on Krishna's behalf I'm accepting these things. But I'm not great. Krishna's great. As long as one keeps that mentality, one's on the safe side.
Pure devotees.
Mm.
So in scriptures we see they are sometimes very all-encompassing statements about pure devotion. All-encompassing, like inclusive, in the sense like one who chants holy name of Krishna once is a pure devotee.
Mm.
Which see the other extreme also, like Haridas Thakur who chants always is a pure devotee. Similarly we see examples in the text, scriptures like Haridas Thakur one hand, Dhruva Maharaj on other hand, who have a little bit like on visible surface, some impurity still, but they are still classified as pure devotees. So you were mentioning that we should take association of pure devotees. So then, what is pure devotion?
Mm. Srila Prabhupada explains sometimes that pure devotee, everyone who takes up Krishna consciousness can be considered a pure devotee because their purpose is pure. Their purpose is pure. The only some of them are immature pure devotees and some of them are mature. Just as there's an unripe mango and then there's a ripe mango. They're both mango. The ones in the mature state. So Srila Prabhupada, there's one time, there was one member of the society who was a leader and he had some quite devoted followers in our society. And one of them was sort of his right-hand man and very devoted. And he wrote a letter to Srila Prabhupada. I didn't see the letter, but from the reply you can get the idea. And what he must have written was that this such and such person is pure devotee and therefore so much regard should be given for him. Prabhupada said, you have the wrong idea. He said, it's not, he said, you're such and such, maybe a pure devotee, but all the devotees are pure devotees. Not only him. So, we have to appreciate all the devotees. There's one devotee, Kali Krishnadas. It's considered very fortunate to take the remnants of food that's been tasted by a pure devotee. They eat, and if we get a little of what's been left by them, that's considered a very, spiritually contagious. We catch their spiritual enthusiasm by eating the food that they've eaten. So this devotee, Kala Krishnadas, he wanted to get the remnants of the food of all the devotees that there were. And he was sort of, targeting this one and this one and this one and this one. And he was coming from a Brahmin family, which means from a high echelon in society, highly regarded.
And but there were other devotees who were from the Shudra category, who were from much lower echelon. And according to the social custom, you would never give your food if you were a Shudra. You'd never expect that a Brahmin would eat the remnants of your food. You know, it's like a truck driver leaving some of his food to be eaten by a priest. You know, it's just like totally backwards. So this Kala Krishnadas, he would scheme. He would like give some mangoes, arrange for some mangoes to be given to these low-class, so-called low-class devotees. And then he would hide. And the devotees would eat the mangoes and discard the peels and the pits. And then after a while, Kala Krishnadas would come out of hiding. And he'd get that prasadam, the remnants of their food. And he'd be very happy. And said that as many devotees as there were in the whole region, he got the prasadam from all of them. But he didn't distinguish, here's a high devotee, here's a low devotee, here's a Brahmin devotee, here's a Shudra devotee. As many devotees as there were. So he got special mercy from Lord Chaitanya because he saw that.
Mid-60s and to the 70s, the streets were infested with hardcore substances and substance abusers. And Srila Prabhupada was literally in the middle of that. What was his approach to bringing these people in and introducing them to any level of devotional service or acceptance?
In the 60s and 70s, the streets were full of various people high on this or that substance. So substance abusers, what was Prabhupada's approach to bringing them to Krishna consciousness? Kirtan, speaking about Krishna, and distributing Krishna prasad. That was his approach. Chant Hare Krishna, the heart will be purified. Speak something about Krishna, they'll get as much knowledge as they can absorb, and give them prasada that will take up the slack. Same program we're doing now. And he wouldn't compromise. When he spoke, he would say, this is what it is. And he wouldn't pussyfoot. And those who were fortunate took him. And even those who were less fortunate at least heard it. Is that okay?
First, I have a story related to what you just asked.
A story?
That somebody once said about Prabhupada and Noxious Gifts, where there was somebody that was sitting in front of Prabhupada. I was chanting, I'm seeing a 360 view around me, and I'm seeing peace and love inside of everybody, and I can see the goodness in everybody's soul. And I'm kind of improvising here, this guy's view. And then just like, saying this big grandiose vision of what he's getting from chanting, and then he's like, Prabhupada, what should I do? And then he says, just keep chanting and it'll all go away. So I always love that story. But I guess my question is, Prabhupada, like, he was very enlightened and extremely high consciousness being, and that's what attracted some of the people to him. But I feel like in parallel, like, not that the Occupy Wall Street cares, but just like, the type of the degree of service and like not trying to actually achieve anything or gain any type of fame from like certain movements. I feel like the word devotee, like pure devotee, like someone that's purely devoted to like Mother Teresa of Christianity, like I believe it's like a pure devotee.
Yeah, pure devotee. Of course, it's not limited to some particular sect or religious community. Anyone from any community can be a pure devotee of Krishna or God. Prabhupada distinguishes it here in this commentary, what he means by pure devotee. He's really glossing a Sanskrit phrase, jnana-karmadhyana-avritam. The meaning is, first of all, he's not devoting himself to something for material enjoyment or material improvement. And he's not, let's stop right there and unpack that a little bit. There are two kinds of material selfishness. One is what Prabhupada called personal selfishness. I want to enjoy what this material world has to offer. And the other is what he called extended selfishness. We want us to enjoy what the world has to offer. So then there's your philanthropy, your charity programs, whatever it is that wants to improve life in this world so that we can stay here and be happy without reviving our Krishna consciousness. We can just carry on in this material world, either individually, collectively, and be happy. That's Prabhupada considered that, or the Vedic literature considers that to be foolishness, to be a manifestation of illusion. Just one is a more altruistic illusion, and the other is a more selfish illusion, but they're both illusion. So, karmadhyanavritam, not covered by that, and jnanam anavritam, not covered by this speculative tendency, I think this, I think that, musing about this and theorizing about that. That won't help us. But actually cultivating activities that are favorable for the service of the Lord. So that's his meaning. And anyone can do that in any community, any part of the world, any religious tradition. But that's the standard. Pure devotional service. Shall we stop here? Yeah? I can take one more. Someone has to give one more, or I can take one more. Maybe there isn't one more. Oh.
This whole time I've just been meditating.
You have to be loud, because you're in the back.
Okay. I've been meditating how you had so much personal association with Srila Prabhupada, a lot of many deep experiences and many very amazing services that you've offered him for many, many years. And I was sitting here wishing, I've known you for quite a few years, Maharaj, and I was realizing that I've rarely heard you speak about your personal memories in Prabhupada, and I'm sure you have your reasons for that, but I was wondering if you'd be willing to share a memory that particularly appreciate or treasure in relation, in regards to this class about being a pure devotee or about service and being a servant.
Okay. Since you're more or less accusing me of being a miser, I'll try to assist. But I have to think. I told one yesterday. Well, this is just a small thing. And maybe I'll just mention this and maybe it'll lead to something else. Just because I was walking on the East River this morning, and I remember that one time we were walking with Srila Prabhupada on the East River. But I think we were walking on the Brooklyn side because our center was in Brooklyn then. And in the distance, there was this the Watchtower buildings. And Prabhupada was walking with a group of devotees. And when Prabhupada would take his walk, lots of times the devotees would want to say something to get a response from Prabhupada. And sometimes they'd want to say something. And sometimes they'd want to show that they knew something, and sometimes they just want to see what Prabhupada would say. So one devotee pointed out that this is the Watchtower Society, and they print so many copies of their magazine. Prabhupada's walking, doing the same thing. Prabhupada, they have 15 presses there for printing their literature. Prabhupada, they have enough paper stored up that in the event of a catastrophe, they could go on printing for so many years. So, what is their philosophy? Nobody knew. Just one thing, Prabhupada used to take his walk. He would walk so fast. I couldn't keep up with him. I mean, I would be exhausted. I'd be so eager to go on the walk, and then halfway through the walk, I really used to walk fast. At 26 Second Avenue, when I first joined, there were three or four young high school girls who were initiated devotees. Mostly it was all guys. At the ashram, all men. There were two young women who were married and living with their husbands. And there were three or four young high school girls who were coming. We were living at home and who were going to school, and then for the evening programs they would come for the kirtan, like this evening's program, they would come. And when Prabhupada was there, they would be quite sentimental. So they would be oohing and aahing. Prabhupada would do anything, and they would go, oh. Prabhupada would pick up some water and drink it, they would, oh. Prabhupada would pick up a drum and play, oh, Swamiji. So all this oohing and aahing, Prabhupada sent a message to them after a day or so, you should be a little brave. One time, we had a meeting about the Back to Godhead magazine. We were with Prabhupada in Boston. He came one year, maybe December. I think subsequently he didn't come at that time of year because it was very cold and not good for his health, and he caught quite a bad cold. But anyway, he was staying in this little house. I don't remember where it was, but I remember we were driving through the snow, through hill and dale,
we reach this little house where Prabhupada was staying. Then we had a discussion with Prabhupada about the Back to Godhead. And someone asked, he was meeting with the editors, they asked if there could be more than one article by him in the magazine. And Prabhupada said, no, everyone, one article per person. Then they asked if they could have maybe one page of conversation. Prabhupada sort of allowed that. Then Prabhupada said, actually, all the articles are written by me. He said, they just should be divided up under different names. Because everyone was just repeating his teachings. Then someone asked, Pradyumna, in fact, those of you who know Pradyumna Guru, he asked if we could print Brahma Sangita in the Back to Godhead. Brahma Sangita is an important book of Krishna consciousness, Sanskrit, which was translated by Srila Prabhupada's spiritual master with very dense commentary, with very, difficult language, very, very, a lot of five-star words.
Esoteric,
almost impenetrable, very difficult language. Tri-quadrantal locations and things like that. So they asked if this could be published in the Back to Godhead. And Prabhupada, he said, all right, he said, but you should publish it in small installments. He said, it will puzzle their brains. And that sort of started Srila Prabhupada reminiscing about his spiritual master. He said that my Guru Maharaj used to speak from the highest elevated platform. He said, even when he would speak in Bengali, he said, I could not understand. He said, but I would like to hear. He said, I would go on hearing, understand or not understand. I would go on hearing. So that was my policy. And my Guru Maharaj noted that this boy likes to hear. And Prabhupada said, because I was enthusiastic about hearing, now I'm enthusiastic about chanting or speaking. As Prabhupada says here, writing. Now I'm enthusiastic about it. Another time in Boston, Prabhupada did a lot of speaking engagements at universities and colleges there. One time, a speaking engagement was arranged at Marsh Chapel at Boston University. And it was arranged at an unfortunate time. I think the students were all on exams. And although it was a big venue, very hardly anyone showed up. It was mainly the Prabhupada's own followers. But one young man came, maybe he was a graduate student or something like that. And anyway, Prabhupada carried on, didn't matter. As he said, you know, that it doesn't matter if there's one person, or even if there's no one, then we'll speak anyway. The spiders in the wall will hear. So he spoke. And after he spoke, one graduate student had a question. And he was asking about what's called Advaita philosophy. Like he mentioned Advaita philosophy. And his idea, as he explained it, was that was essentially the idea of oneness, that we're like drops
of water. And as we become self-realized or God-realized, the drops merge and become one with the ocean. So he was putting forward that approach to spiritual consciousness. The Prabhupada said, that's all right. He said, but the drop of ocean, water, when that drop merges with the ocean, again, the sun will come and evaporate that drop. And it's deposited again on the land. So there's no certainty of being able to stay and merge with the water. But if you become an aquatic, if you become a fish in the water, then you can stay permanently and play within the ocean. The Prabhupada said, that's our philosophy, to merge in the ocean but maintain our individuality. There is a video where I've told as many things as I can remember. In fact, there's one of my godbrothers, Siddhanta Das, has done the very commendable service of interviewing as many devotees as he's been able to reach, as many of Srila Prabhupada's direct disciples as he's been able to reach. And that's recorded in a video series called Memories. And those memories are available. You can Google them, memories videos. Of course, our Yadavara Prabhu has also done wonderful videos with footage of Srila Prabhupada, accompanied by devotees remembering what was taking place while what was being videoed was happening. Yes, remembering what was happening when the videos were filmed. So there are a lot of Prabhupada memories, and of course there's always more. Our Giriraj Swami, usually when you ask us for Prabhupada memories, we remember the same thing that we've told some other occasion. My godbrother Giriraj Swami, he always remembers something new. Remarkable, yes. I mean, you think I had a lot of association. I had a little association with Prabhupada. Something. Most of my association was by service, not by direct physical proximity. But Giriraj Maharaj had both. He did a lot of service, of course, for Srila Prabhupada, and he had a lot of personal association. I always remember something new. I guess a blind monk is better than no uncle. Try to remember something. But on that video, there's a Siddhanta did a video with it, and whatever I could remember is there. Maybe now and then I'll remember something else. Memory is such a cool thing. Some devotee was experiencing, or some newcomer was experiencing, reported as experiencing all symptoms of ecstasy, rolling on the ground and crying. Prabhupada commented, first to cry, first to dry. Make a big show on day one, and a week later you're gone. As Prabhupada said, it's not a process of imaginative ecstasy, but practical service. Finish. So, instruct me what I should do.